Hello, this is Gideon Rothstein, and this is Response of the Day for the first day of Rosh Chodesh Elul. Thank you, Rabbi Jacob Bromowitz and David Hochhauser, for their assistance in putting these shiurim online, making them available to you. And today we're going to see a tshuva of the Chatam Sofer from the second volume from Chelek Bet in Yoredeah. Response number 9. One of the underlying aspects of this tshuva that I find interesting is that it doesn't actually get into it, but it sort of raises the questions of monopolies and how they work. Because the underlying reality, the question of the tshuva is, there was a man named Rav Dov in the tshuva, and this Rav Dov was a shochet. He was a ritual slaughterer, and he had committed in a letter, and the document is shown or copied over, for Chatam Sofer to examine, in which another shochet, Reb Chaim, was the shochet for a certain neighborhood, a certain area. And this Rav Dov had to make a commitment to this Reb Chaim in order to get a certification from him that he would be allowed to do shechita in the area. Now, some of the things that are going to come up here is that Rav Dov is going to claim that he said some things that he didn't mean because Reb Chaim was in control of the area so much that he couldn't get his certification without at least committing to certain things to this Reb Chaim. So part of what is going on here is you have a guy who's in control of something and he's making certain conditions before another guy can come into that area, and you have to think to yourself, there's two possibilities basically. One is Chaim is a monopolist and he just want to keep people out for the sake of making money, and the other possibility is that, or it's not really sort of a complete other possibility, but it's that the monopoly is given to Reb Chaim because he couldn't make a go of his life as a shochet otherwise. If he couldn't make a go of his life as a shochet, he would have to move somewhere else, and then this area would be left without a shochet. So these are communal issues that come up not so infrequently, where you could say one possibility is they're trying to keep out competition. The other possibility is they're not making enough money on their own anyway. So in capitalist countries, very often they say to themselves, no, we think competition is good. It lowers prices, it helps people out. And if people can't make it in that industry, then they'll go out of business. It's not even always true in capitalist countries, because there are times when governments decide to grant a monopoly on something because they think it's necessary, otherwise the thing won't happen. So public utilities used to be like that. The whole question about when to take it off, when did not happen, right? And another issue is, you don't really want to say to some kinds of public functionaries, well, you know, if you go to business, then you'll move, because then they won't start. And then you won't have anybody who's willing to do it, right? If I'm going to think about becoming a shochet, or a rav in our times today, and you said to me, and there were times when this was sort of true for rabbis, let's say, he said, well, you might not be able to make a living. You can't make a living. You'll move to another place. You'll make a living there. So there are dedicated rabbis from the Jewish past who spent their lives moving around. In America, for sure. In America, in the 19th and 20th century, there were rabbis who spent their time spending 3 years here and 5 years there and 7 years there. And for as long as that's true, and it's uncomfortable for rabbis, then other people say, why would I bother going into becoming a rabbi? I can become a lawyer, and I can stay in one place. So these are complicated questions that come up, and they are an undercurrent here, because the commitment that this Rav Dov had to make was, he says, I'm making this commitment, he says, I'm swearing. And he says, not only am I now swearing in writing, I also have sworn by holding on to a Sefer Torah or a Chumash, an item of mitzvah. It's called a Shvua Benikitat Chifetz, an oath where you hold on to something. And it's based on Avram Avinu when he sends Eliezer to find Rivka for Yitzchak. He has him take hold of a mitzvah item, and it's seen as being a way to make an oath more serious. So when you have a shvua d'oraita, an oath at a Torah level, the Torah required, you always do it in Nikitat Chayfetz. But Chazal instituted, sometimes you could have a shvua d'rabanan, and to increase its seriousness, you would have it be done in Nikitat Chayfetz. So he says he did that, and the commitment he made was not to do shechita, and not do bedika. So bedika is when you check the animal that the shechita went well, or you check the knife. The knife is still kosher to be used for shechita, for ritual slaughter. And he said, I'm not going to do any of this without checking in with this Reb Chaim, meaning I'm going to be basically a complete underling to him in terms of my business. And any expansions of my business that I try to do, any attempts that I'm going to check in with him on everything, and I'm only going to act if he allows me to. And he says, I'm assigning this in the letter, it says, in the document, it says, I'm doing this in my own free will, and I would never want to do anything to hurt this Reb Chaim, and it applies not only to where we are, but all the surrounding villages, because remember, in those times, shechita wasn't an industry you had to went to a slaughterhouse, it was you had people who knew how to do shechita, and the people would bring them animals they wanted to shechita, because there wasn't enough shechita going on that you would just say, well, we'll just shecht. Right today, you have a big industry, you go to wherever you go, Agriculture, Denver, wherever there's shechita, Harrisburg is a place of shechita, Shemitah, there may still be today, I don't know. And they shecht a lot of things. Then they refrigerate it or freeze it and send it out. Until you have good refrigeration or freezing, you can't ship it. So if you can't ship it, then you're going to have local shoktim who will do shechita for those who need it. So he's saying, I won't do that in this area unless I don't do it for myself, I won't do it for other people, I won't do it for free, I won't do it for money, I won't check lungs, I won't check knives, I won't do anything without the approval of this Reb Chaim. And I never want to cause him any trouble, I never want to cause him any problems, and this is all he says, I accept it with a, you know, big Isser Chamor, and there's nothing, no funny business here, basically, and I'm taking an oath, and I'm writing the oath, and that's what he writes. So now, he wants to get out of it. Except that the document seems pretty ironclad. You know, he'd gone as far as to say further on, he had said, I'm doing this of my own free will, and there's no coercion here, and I'm worried about Hasagat V'gul, that I'd be stepping into his business if I went against what I'm committing to here, and if I violate it, I'm saying that my shkita will be not count as a good shkita, and I can't eat it, and other people shouldn't be allowed to eat it, and so on. And that's from the 15th Vav of Tavkuf Tzadi Zion of 1837. So now he says he didn't really mean it, this Rav Dov. He didn't really mean it. He only said it because Rav Chaim was in control and he had to say something to be able to get a Kabbalah of a Shkita to be certified as a Shokate. But he didn't mean it. B, he didn't commit to it. And C, he doesn't think he should be obligated by it. So, Chazam Sofer starts, and throughout the Tshuva, it seems to be clear, and I don't know why he thinks this. It could be that he knows more information that we don't know. But it seems clear that the Chazam Sofer assumed that this Rav Chaim was a good guy, and that he had the right, and it wasn't terrible of him to want to retain the monopoly on the shechita in the area because he was barely making his living. All of that seems to be underlying assumptions, and those, I think, would affect how you react to the situation. So he's responding to the rabbi who wrote to him about the question. He says, first of all, the whole question of, this is a halachic question. If I write down those, but I never say it, I write down on a paper, I hereby swear, and whatever it is that I swear. I never say the words out loud. Does that count as a halachically binding oath? So on the one hand, you could say, well, I very clearly made my intentions known that I intended to take that oath. But on the other hand, I didn't say anything. And it could be that oaths are only created verbally. That's a possibility, right? It could be an oath is all, the whole idea of an oath and a halakha to me, Gino Rothstein, GROTHST@gmail.com, that whole idea to me is very surprising because it allows a person to create an Isser D'oraisa, a prohibited D'oraisa, or an obligation on a Torah level. So once we're allowing or for creating a situation where that can be created, so then if you said to me, but technically it can only be done orally, I think that's a possibility, right? It's a whole big chiddush, it's a whole novel idea. So the Chatzam Sofer says, you know, I wrote about this a long time, a long psak, a long ruling. I wrote it 26 years ago. I have nothing to add. So I always find that kind of thing interesting because, and I know this from not in any way comparing myself to the Chatzam Sofer, but let's say I've written something on an issue and it's not been well read and nobody cares about it. And somebody asks me that exact question, I can easily imagine saying, well, you know, I wrote about that. Since the Ezra does it too, he talks about people asking questions. Well, you know, I wrote about that 12 volumes ago. Now, in his case, that's an odd, interesting thing to watch because do you really expect everybody to read every volume of Tzitzel Ezer you bring out? But of course, if you're to the Ezer, and that's what you do with your life, and you're bringing out these volumes, you'd like people to read them, and they matter to you, and you've done it. So the Chazam Sofer says, I wrote a long time ago about it, and I don't have anything to add. But basically, he thinks that, yes, it counts as an oath. But even if it doesn't count as an oath, even if you were telling me that if you only, and that could be, let's say, a guy comes to me and says, listen, I made this oath in writing, I never said it out loud, am I still bound by it? Because I need to do a heter and a darim, I need to get rid of it because of whatever happened. But the answer might be no, because if you just wrote it, it doesn't count as an oath. Even if that's not true, even if it's that you must articulate an oath before it becomes binding, this Rav Dov had in fact said that he accepted this upon himself and that he had made the oath orally and holding on to an item. So therefore, even if somebody were to disagree with the Chatzam Sofer and think the written oath doesn't count as an oath, in this case, what he wrote down was not only that he was writing that he was taking an oath, but he had actually verbally and orally taken an oath as well. Now he's claiming, though, that he didn't actually take it. He's claiming that he wrote that down falsely. It wasn't true that he had taken the oath. He wrote it down because this Reb Chaim, who's the monopolist in this case, forced him to, and otherwise he could get a Kabbalah of the Shechita. So Chazam Sofer points out that there's a Truma Hadesh in Shin Chav Vav 326, which says that if the person who's claiming against this Rav Dov, in this case, if this Rav Chaim were to agree that he in fact not taken the oath, he just wrote it down as an oath, then if this Rav Dov comes later with an excuse, that excuse is called an Amatla. An Amatla is an important point in this Tshuva, which we won't get as fully into it as the Chazam Sofer does, but he discusses at length this question of when someone, this is a halakhic question that comes up in a couple of cases. We'll see a few of them here. But if somebody does an action which seems to make X point, so an example that will come up in the tshuva is, there's a halakha, let's say a woman, it seems to be in the time of the Shulchan Aruch, women had special nida clothing. They had no clothing that they wore when they were nidot, and it seems to have been relatively known, like at least the women of the town would know when a woman was wearing her nida clothing, maybe the husband would know. So let's say a woman starts wearing her nida clothing, which would seem to imply that she's a nida. And then, you know, that night, two nights later, when it's not yet enough time that if she had been a nida, she could now no longer be a nida, she indicates to her husband that she's not a nida. So that would seem to be not allowed because she's already made clear that she is a nida and she's done it in front of other people. But if she gives an amatla, if she gives a reason that explains her behavior such that her behavior coherently fits with a narrative in which she's not actually a nida, but yet wears the clothing, there's room in certain situations to accept. That's what an amatla is. Amatla is an explanation of why my actions, which carried at their simplest reading X meaning, don't actually have that meaning, right? They clearly should have had that meaning, but they don't. So here, this Rav Dov is trying to give an amatla. For all that, he signed the document that says he took an oath, and at the very least expresses his acceptance of the idea as if he had taken an oath. That's called that he was moded to something. In halakha, if somebody is moded to something, they can create either obligations or prohibitions upon themselves, even if the halakhically. So sometimes, let's say, if a man comes to a Beit Din and says, I saw my wife do X, that might be, or I know that this food is, you know, let's say there's a wedding about to happen. This is a great case that came to my mind. Let's say there's a wedding that happened, not a real case, a case I'm thinking of, a wedding about to happen, and I'm just one witness, and I come to a Beit Din and I say, listen, all the food at that wedding is not kosher for X and Y reasons. Right, but for let's say for whatever reason I'm not believed about that. Right, you normally say Eidech has never been certain, but then there's a reason why the court is not required to believe me. So they're allowed to believe that this food is still kosher, but I will have what's called shavya anafshe chaticha de isura. I will have made that food prohibited to myself because I've said that as far as I know that it's prohibited, so I can't eat that food. So the question is, when this Rav Dov signs a paper which either in fact says he made an oath, or in which he at least admits he made an oath, and therefore it should be obligatory on him. But now he brings in amatla, and the amatla is saying, I didn't mean any of it, and I'm doing it for, he's trying to give a valid reason for why he did it, that would not then obligate him. So the Tshuva Sedeshin says that only works if the Toveya agrees the actual action that we're talking about didn't occur. If, in other words, if Toveya came in with the document, and he said, no, he really didn't ever take up the oath, but he made this agreement with me in the paper, and the guy says, well, I didn't really take the oath because I didn't really mean it. That's right, I'm out like it worked. But where the Toveya, this Ruchayim is saying, no, there was an actual oath. He held the pay, he held the Torah, and he held the Chumash, he held whatever, and he made an oath. So there, we don't believe in Amatla. And that will mean the ramifications of this are that if he's violated the agreement with Rav Dov, he will no longer be allowed to do Shrita in the whole region that had been apportioned to this Ruchayim. That's the oath element of it, that he would have to fill it, and the amatla element of it, that we don't believe his amatla, his excuse. But the Chazal Sofer says, but I want you to remember that I also hold, that I've written this to you before, that if Rav Dov comes to Rav Chaim and he needs a sheet of paper from him saying, Rav Dov is qualified to do Shrita, and Rav Chaim says, listen, I'm sorry, I can only give you that certification. Now, today, people say, well, I understand. If Rav Dov knows how to be shochet, then it's the obligation of Rav Chaim to certify him. But remember that in times when monopolies are sometimes necessary to protect people's livelihoods, because otherwise we won't have shechita around, then Rav Chaim is given the power to decide when he will or won't allow other shochtim into the neighborhood. And if he says, listen, Rav Dov, these are the conditions in which I'm giving you the certification, says Chatham Sofer, Rav Dov is required to agree. I think about this often. I used to think about this. It's not such a common thing anymore in the same way, but back in the days when there were things called tapes, and you would tape music, and then people would tape from each other, I remember thinking about the fact that people would say, well, it doesn't hurt anybody, but if I get a tape from somebody, and they make a condition when they sell me this tape of music, now I'm only selling you the right to play this, not to let others record it, I've accepted it in those conditions. And so the Chatam Sofer says, you can't cheat people out of their livelihoods, out of their deserved reward. So if Rav Chaim is the shochet for the town, and Rav Dov makes an agreement with him, he can't cheat him. Now, it gets complicated for people when they say, well, but so-and-so's rich, right? So they don't need the money. So I'm only taping off of this, I'm only this, right? You think about when there were things like music sharing services online, and people would say, well, I'm just taking a song, just borrowing a song. So that's a stealing question, right? If you have a person who composes music or composes a song, and they're selling it, they're selling the right to listen to it, and they're not selling the right to to, as it happened, give other people the download of it, that becomes a big question, a big problem. And it's here where you see that Chatham Kofar, Sofer, thinks of this Reb Chaim as a poor person, right? Skar and Yvonne, he's thinking it seriously because he says, Skar Pulato Shalom Reb Chaim Shalom Yafsik Chiyuto. You don't want to get into his livelihood. And therefore, the Beit Din really needs to force Rav Dov to keep to his condition because Rav Chaim needs protection. That's the way Chatham Sofer understands the situation. He also says the whole idea of an amatla to explain why he's violating his oath would only work, even if it worked, would only work, and this is think about it, an excuse, and to think about it, that would work if he came to court before he acted on it. And he came to a court and he said, I never made the oath, or I only made the oath because I was coerced into it. I want to be freed of the oath so that I can do shchita now because I never meant it. So then there's a possibility, depending on how we ruled on the amatla question, on the question of whether the excuse counts or doesn't count, whether the, it's not an excuse so much as the retroactive explanation for one's conduct rings true or not, that whole question would be a question, an issue halachically, if he came to check out before he did it. But once he violates whatever it was he agreed to, the commitment he made, then the amatla doesn't work, and that's a rash would say. In addition, he says that this Rav Dov, there's two possibilities. Either, because he's now done shkita apparently in the region with that, well, against the agreement. So we have to think about this Rav Dov now. He has clearly done something wrong at some point. The one possibility is that he took a false oath way back when, because he felt coerced into it, but it was a false oath nonetheless, and that would mean that back then he was a bad person. He has an excuse for it, and that excuse might therefore lead us to not require him to uphold the oath. But he did take the oath, or he seems to be agreeing that he took the oath, he just did it under coercion, but he took the oath, that would be a wrong thing. Or we could say that no, when he took the oath, he was sincere, and it wasn't coerced, and it was a meaningful oath, and he meant it. Now he's just come to realize that he needs to improve his shkita business, as it were, and he feels restricted by the oath too much, and therefore he wants to violate it. So, in halacha, if I have a situation where I have something, but it was good, right, and then they have a cheskat kashrut, they have a status as being a good person, and then they have lost that status, because they now know that at some point they did something wrong. We in halacha tend to assume that we say they did something wrong as later as possible, because we want to leave them, we want to leave our perspective of them as being good and keeping to the Torah the right way for as long as we can. So they will say a hashta hudit. So that's a chazaka principle, that we try to, we have a chazaka, we have an established state of affairs, and when we know that it's going to change, we say it changes as later as possible, we can allow it change. So we'll say he was a good person, he was a tzaddik, he was doing the right thing, and he meant to keep a condition, there was no coercion. But if we believe his reconstruction of events, right, if we believe his amatla, then you have to say that the time that he did it, he was planning already on fooling Reb Chaim. He was saying, this is Reb Chaim, he's a monopolist, he's not fair to me, I'm going to take the oath, but I don't mean it, and then I'll do what I want. Chazam Sofer says, and I think it's an interesting claim, think about it, he says, no, we should be okia cheskat daka, we should keep him as for as long as we can in the status of being a good, fine, upstanding Jew. Which, of course, worked out bad for this Reb Dov, because then it means that he's somebody who transgressed an oath that he had made, and then it gets to all sorts of complicated issues for how you're going to rehabilitate him or not, and what he's going to have to do about his livelihood as a shochet. So there's a whole bunch more to this Chatham Sofer, and sometimes in our project here, I have to cut out many parts of Tshuvot because I didn't think I can present them either coherently or with enough brevity or with avoiding technicalities that I might not be able to communicate in a way that I would hope would be interesting. So in this case, there's a whole long discussion of amatla and when amatla works and when it's really a very important halakhic concept and halakhic situation, because you have people who say, I know that it looks like that's what I did, but that's not what I did. And those can be important context and relevant context to a situation for us to understand how to judge it fully. Then he goes on to say, so that's as far as he knows the halakha, that's as far as his concern, that's what he thinks the halakha, how the halakha comes out badly for Rav Dov, because it turns out that he thinks he can believe the document. Once you believe the document, and that Rav Dov's later attempts to recast how it came about are not convincing and don't sway him for the various reasons we've already said. And therefore, it turns out that Rav Dov violated an oath, and then you have to figure out how to rehabilitate him, what's going on. But then this Rav, apparently, when he wrote to the Chatham Sofer, had given his whole reasoning of it. I pointed out before that part of the reason to do that is because when you're coming to ask a question, you don't want to seem like you're an idiot. You want to seem like you did some research or you did some thinking about it or you know something about it. It's not just, I don't know what to do. I'm going to ask Chasam Sofer. It's you worked on it. So this guy had apparently said, he says, the Chasam Sofer says, the stuff that you sent me isn't really halakha l'maisa because it's not about this case. He's doing all these all these things that show your bakiyus, your wide-ranging knowledge, and I don't really have time to get into it because it's long and it's not specifically halachically relevant. So I'm going to look at, I looked through one of your essays, B'kuntres Echad Mishnei Kuntres Sav, of your two long essays. So people's times are short and brief and they don't always have time for it, but it's an interesting thing to think about what do postgame choose to look at or not choose to look at, what draws their attention, what doesn't. So in this case, this Rav had written him apparently a whole arichos, as they would say, a whole long thing, and he didn't have the time or interest in looking at the whole thing. So he says, out of respect for you, I'm going to look at one of them. So this Rav was contrasting two cases that come up in terms of a matla. Let's say you have a shochet, not our shochet, but just a general case of a shochet, who makes a sign on a bunch of his animals that they are ksherot. And then later wants to say they're not actually short, or the other way around. He wants to say they're not actually trefo, they're not actually bad, he can sell them. And he gives it a matla on a reason to believe that they are kosher. That's the case. He puts on their trefo, they're not kosher, and then he starts selling them. We say, what are you doing? You can't sell them, those are not kosher. He says, no. I only made a sign on them, let's say, for example, because I knew that so-and-so rich man was making a wedding, he was going to come, he was going to take all my kosher animals. I know there are people in my neighborhood who very much need their meat, and I didn't want to have them lose it to this rich guy, and I wouldn't have been able to resist that rich guy. So I put a sign on them, their trefo, and I told them I would take care of him in another way. Let's say I would run off and do shkita for him over the course of the next week or two. And he said, okay, whatever. That would be an amatla. There an amatla we seem to accept. Whereas in the woman case, if she wore the bigdei nida, if she wore clothing as if she's a nida, and now she wants to say that she's not actually a nida, so the standards for her to be believed are much higher. And it's much more complicated for her to believe because the wearing of the clothing of Nida seems to be a very strong act. So this rabbi had suggested that the reason for that is that most animals are kosher, and that's why we believe when the shochet tries to change his mind and say, no, really, the animals are kosher, that's because most animals are kosher. Most kosher types of animals that have been slaughtered by a shochet are kosher. Whereas women, he claims, this other rabbi claims, aren't bechez katar all the time. They can't always be thought of as non-nidot because they're going to be nidot at some point. So since they're going to become nidot at some point, if she takes an action that shows that she's claiming that she's a nida, that fits in with our majority perception anyway. So that was his claim. His claim was that a matla has a harder time if it's trying to go against the majority perception, the majority understanding what's going to happen, as opposed to whether it's going to fit in with that majority situation. So the butcher fits the majority situation, that's why he's believed with the amatla and not the woman. And he tried to say that would be fit into that. Proof for that or support for that would be that we have a chazaka in halacha about a shliach. A shliach osed shlichuto. So he's neman matla to say, you know, that I made a mistake. Meaning that if we have a general assumption that messengers do what they were sent to do, so that helps us. If the messenger later does something that looks like he didn't do what he was supposed to do and he gives an explanation for it, it fits. So that's his claim. So Chazazara clearly doesn't like the guy's thinking. He says, anybody who's learned anything about Nida, Kol ba'i shari hilchot nida. Everybody learning about nida knows that we actually assume that women are generally taharot for their husbands. It's true that in their fertile years, women monthly become nidot for a period of time. That might even be, you know, half a month at a time, basically. No, not half a month, that's wrong. No, it might be up to about half a month, depending on how long her period goes. But it could be, you know, 2 weeks at a time. Even so, we have a general halachic principle that women are beches katar, and that principle in halacha of women are beches katar the ba'ala, that we generally assume women, unless we know otherwise, are allowed to be living with their husbands and having ordinary marital relations, is a stronger chazak in halacha. It's assumed to be a stronger chazak in halacha than the whole idea of shliach okse shlichuto. How do I know? Because when it comes to the right to issues, we don't say shliach okse shlichuto, meaning if I need to know that whether a messenger fulfilled his job, and that will affect the right issue that I have to think about, we do not allow ourselves in halacha to assume. So, for example, let's say today, when men only marry one wife, let's say a man sends another man with a get for his wife. He's currently married. Sadly, the marriage has come to an end for whatever reasons. He's sending a bill of divorce to his wife. Doesn't take effect until the messenger fulfills his job of messengership. So the truth is that the Doraita case, because he could marry a second wife on a Doraita level, but let's assume that it was. Or let's assume he now wants to marry a woman. He can't marry while he's married to that first woman. Case isn't coming to my mind, but I'm sure there are cases like that. I want to marry somebody, and he wants to marry somebody he would not be allowed to marry until he's divorced from the first wife at a Torah level. We do not allow ourselves to say, oh, I can assume it's done. You got to wait until you know it. Whereas, Isha Becheska Tara, it's a chazaka that we use in lots of cases that we allow ourselves to assume a woman is permitted to her husband. So, for example, the Rashba says, let's suppose that a woman knows she has an internal wound that would lead to her bleeding in a way that could look like menstrual bleeding, but she knows she has a wound there, so we're allowed to assume that that wound is what's producing blood even at her veset, even at her time when we expect her to menstruate. And part of the reason for that is it's supported by the chazaka of the Nisha is because Katara. So the chazaka is saying, so your reasoning doesn't work because of the chazaka issues. You got them wrong. The chazaka that a woman is Torah leba'ala, the guy had said, the majority of women become nidot, will menstruate, and therefore, that's why we don't believe her amadla. But the chazaka says, I don't know what you're talking about. You then turn me to the messenger issue, but the strength of our halachic assumption that women are allowed to be living with their husbands is much stronger than that one. So that's apparently not the relevant factors in our situation. Another area that I thought the guy got wrong was this other rabbi had said that cheskas penuya, that the chazaka that a woman is not married. If we know at a certain point that a woman is not married, she has what's called a cheska penuya. We have an established fact that she's not married. So that chazaka, so usually in halacha, halachic presumptions continue on until we know that they've changed. So here we would say, I assume she's not married. So for example, let's suppose I knew a woman was not married, and then we saw her having, or we saw a reason to believe that she had relations with a man. So if she got married in between, that would mean it's a marital affair, and then we'd have to deal with it as a marital affair. But the fact is, we have a chazaka that she's not married, so we wouldn't treat it like that. That's a chazaka. So this rabbi had claimed, no, we don't treat it as a chazaka because biyada lekadesh atzma, she has the ability to marry herself to somebody, to accept kiddushin, to create a marriage with somebody else. So therefore, it's not a full chazaka. So the chazaka says, so that's not a good claim either. And there's a bunch more here. And it's interesting to watch the chazaka write at some length, just out of respect for this man, who apparently doesn't really know how to learn that well because he knows a lot of stuff, but he puts it all together in one way. It's all another area of sort of Jewish thought to think about, all the people in the world who learned a lot of Torah and got it completely wrong. And what does that say about, if we meet somebody and they know a lot of Torah, what does that say about our ability to trust that not only do they know a lot of technical Torah, but they also got it right, they know how to deal with the halakha correctly and how to analyze it correctly. How do we do that? So that's a question that's raised to me by this response to this rabbi. So there's more to it. I think we'll stop here because I think that's gotten the main lines of what the Chatam Sofer is pointing out, that when it comes, there are complicated halakhic questions of chazaka, of established presumptions, and how long those continue or don't continue. There are actions that people take, and whether we believe them or not, when they have the right to excuse themselves later, reconfigure what occurred in order to claim that it wasn't what it looked like, and all those situations will be we'll figure into whether or not we can accept the later excuse that what looks like one kind of an action didn't really mean it to be that way. In this case, the case of Rav Dov and his attempt to get out of, to wriggle his way out of a commitment he made to Rav Chaim, to the Shechita, I think quite probably in a place where that Shechita was a delicate, tense situation because there wasn't enough of it to go around, and this Rav Chaim, Rav Dov, was really meaningfully interfering with the capability of Rav Chaim to earn his living. And that is a responsible day for the first day of Rosh Chodesh Elul from Tavkuf Tzadi Chet from 1838 by the Chatam Sofer. We thank Rabbi Jacob Ramowitz, David Hakhauser, and the OU, and we hope you have a great day. Bye.